You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by Indeed Sponsored Jobs. Now, if you're in charge of recruitment for your company, Indeed is all you need. You won't struggle to get your job seen by the right people because Indeed Sponsored Jobs will propel your job ad to the very top of the list and attract all of the best quality candidates to drive your business forward. If you were recruiting for a cycling team, you'd have your budget and you'd identify the type of rider you want, the skills and experience that they have, and then you would sift through before settling on your ideal candidate. And it's very much the same when recruiting for any business. Indeed can really make a difference because, according to Indeed's data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed are 90% more likely to report a hire than non-sponsored jobs because you reach a bigger pool of top quality candidates. So spend more time interviewing candidates who check all of your boxes. There's less stress, less wasted time, and better results with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. Listeners to the Cycling Podcast will get a £100 sponsored job credit to help get your job the premium status it deserves. Go to indeed.com/cycle. That's indeed.com/cycle. And by using that URL, you'll be supporting the show. Say that you heard about Indeed on the Cycling Podcast. Indeed.com/cycle. Terms and conditions apply. If you're hiring, do it the right way with Indeed. Now it's on with the show.
Hello, welcoming you on January the 22nd, birth date in 1889 of Henri Pélissier, who once abandoned the Tour de France while second in general classification because his hotel refused to serve him a bottle of wine. Had I been covering the Tour at the time, Henri would have received my wholehearted solidarity. My name is Daniel Freeber. I'm the host of this episode of Cycling Podcast, in which we will try to temper all petulant instincts and figuratively ride on into the cycling season, which has just begun physically in the last couple of days. Joining me in that pursuit today is a man whose long-standing affection for the Tour Down Under is well known. It's Lionel Burney.
G'day, Daniel. G'day, Larry.
So authentic, that accent. Lionel, you've never abandoned. You haven't yet abandoned the Tour de France because you haven't been served a bottle of wine in a hotel, but you probably considered
I've considered abandoning the Tour de France on many occasions when we've turned up at restaurants to be told that we're too late by sort of 2 minutes, you know, 2 minutes past nine, and Madame and Monsieur are no longer serving. That's enough for me to feel like peeling my numbers off my back and going and sulking in the back seat of the car. But no, so far I haven't abandoned the tour midway through.
Well, no sulking today, Lionel, because we have been joined by a very special guest. We've got a real professional cyclist with us today, Lionel. It is the Motown Maestro. It is Larry Warbass of Tudor Pro Cycling. The clue is in the name. Larry, Happy New Year. How are you doing? Where are you?
I am in Nice at the moment, or as more specifically. So just back at home, did a pretty long, like, 2 week training camp in Spain, and yeah, now I'm just home for a week before heading to Mallorca Challenge. So glad to be here.
You're
with
already
you guys
doing a sort of tour of the Med, aren't you? Spain, Mallorca next. Lovely stuff.
Then Oman, which is a little bit further off, but yeah.
Larry, how are you feeling? How are you feeling generally about this season?
Yeah, I feel pretty good. I mean, we had some solid training camps. Yeah, I've gotten, I just a really good winter of training. And yeah, I've been pretty consistent with everything. So no, it's good. I'm looking forward to it. And yeah, I think hopefully it'll be a good year.
We were talking earlier about, well, the fact that you're deep into your pro career, aren't you? And we're going to be talking a little bit later on about riders who have had or are having shorter careers. But you're indefatigable, Larry. You just keep going. Going, don't you?
I mean, I try. We'll see.
What's this? This is season number 14, is that right?
Yeah, Larry? 14, yeah.
I can already say, Larry, I can already reveal to the listeners that one area in which you've already fallen slightly short this year, replying to some of my messages, first thing on the charge sheet. Second thing, predictions. Last week was our speculation episode, our predictions episode. We solicited your expertise, your clairvoyance, before the episode, but you just missed the deadline. The drawbridge just went up. You were cut adrift, Larry. So do you have anything for us? Trends, controversies, race winners, breakthrough riders?
I mean, I think Tade is going to continue on his tear. I'd give him a win in Sanremo this year because I think he's really motivated for that.
He's been doing his homework, hasn't he? He's been training with Nicolò Bonifazio, the retired Italian rider. Yeah.
But I think he's been working on his sprint and everything to really try to like go for Sanremo. So I feel like if he really sets his mind to something, he'll probably achieve it. I would not be surprised to see him win Sanremo, which I think would be cool, actually. Then I'm not sure the Remco transfer will be the best move in the end. I think Quickstep was actually a pretty good setup. I'm not sure it's going to go super well at Red Bull, at least not in the first year.
Wilbur slams Evenepoel.
No, I don't know. No. That's just like a guess.
Before we start recording, Lionel and I were having a long meandering rant to each other about attention farming. But the resolution of that was that we are going to do our best to farm more attention on the cycling podcast with headlines like Warbass slams.
No. I'm not slamming him. I think he's an amazing rider. I just don't know if the transfer was a good decision. Breakout rider on my team, this Matisse Rondel, young French guy, I think he'll have some breakthrough rides this season.
Is he the fellow that is from the Alps but lives in the Pyrenees?
Well, he lives in the Pyrenees, but he's not from the Alps. So he's from like Le Mans. So I think that's kind of like middle of France. And he moved to the Pyrenees. His whole family moved with him for his cycling. So pretty crazy. Yeah, he has some farm animals and stuff. And he's like, yeah, I don't know. He bought some house in the Pyrenees and he's redoing it all himself. And yeah, he's an interesting guy. Yeah, hard worker, super motivated. And I think he'll do some big things.
Well, I was going to say Larry was outside the time limit for the predictions last week, missed last week's episode. I was actually looking at Larry's career a little bit earlier today on Pro Cycling Stats. Larry's 14th season as a pro. You turned pro just before the cycling podcast started. So if you do feel the onset of burnout, I completely understand. I empathize with you. It feels like quite a long time. Cycling feels like it's changed an awful lot since 2013. But one thing that I noticed when I was looking back through all of your race results, Larry, you've never finished outside the time limit in a race, according to the official stats. And also, you've got a very high, I would suggest, average finishing position in races.
Okay, interesting.
Right? It's just a sight test. Looking at the positions in all the races, very few finishes in any races in the hundreds. You tend to be in the first half of the field in pretty much every race.
Yeah, he's insinuating that you're a selfish rider. You should have been sitting up and conserving energy, but no.
Larry the locomotive, yeah, riding in as hard as possible. No, it's just, I think it's testament to your kind of versatility, consistency. But yeah, we'll maybe touch on some of that when it comes to talking about the issue of burnout and the intensity in the peloton these days later on in this episode.
Lionel, did your extensive statistical, more forensic deep dive, thanks to that, were you able to ascertain that Larry's average finishing position was higher or lower than Tadej Pogacar's?
Oh, I'm going to guess it's probably lower. But that's because very high finishing positions will obviously skew the average in Pogacar's favour. I might sit. I've got nothing else to do. I might sit and work it out. I'll use AI to work it out.
We will talk about some real race results in part two.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
This episode of the cycling podcast is brought to you by BICMO Cycle Insurance, because let's face it, things happen. Whether it's a crash landing, the heartbreak of a stolen bike, or the ultimate facepalm moment of reversing over your prized aero wheel, BICMO has you covered. Flexible policies that you can cancel anytime, 50% off extra bikes in your household, protection for your kit, race entries, and even damage while travelling to your next epic ride. They've thought of it all. And here's the thing, BICMO isn't some faceless insurance company. They're all bike riders too, with a shared mission to protect the world's riders and the places we ride. So when you insure with them, you're not just getting great coverage, you're joining a community that gets what it means to love cycling. So whether you're smashing sprints, grinding climbs, or just enjoying a Sunday spin, ride safe. BICMO's got your back. Protect your ride before it's too late. Head to BICMO.com to get covered. That's BICMO.com. Flexible policies. Cancel any time. Terms apply. Check your policy docs.
As promised, we are going to talk about some real racing that has actually occurred in real life in just a moment in Tour Down Under. But Larry, a few predictions there from you. One thing that I thought you might talk about, I was going to ask you about. Usually you're pretty good on performance trends, and I solicited predictions from a few people on performance trends. Didn't get too many back. We talked last week about products, fads that might be used, faddish products, broccoli juice, noni fruit juice, New Zealand blackcurrant extract. Anything coming down the tubes, Larry, that you're aware of or you would predict?
Trying to think. I mean, I'd say the supplement front is probably going to stay about the same. Bicarb still going to be a big thing. The carb revolution is just going to keep increasing. I think like people are just going to keep eating more and more carbs. So I think, you know, before it was like 120. Now I think it's just going to keep going up from 120 grams per hour. I'd say, okay, like this trend towards shorter cranks is probably going to solidify itself. I think, yeah, like most people are probably going shorter and I think they'll stay that way. And then we'll see maybe, I don't know, different bike fitting trends. I think maybe we'll start to see guys adopting like slightly different positions in the past. Whereas like in the past, it was always slammed stems and like super long positions. I think guys are probably going to start going like higher than before, like less slam stems, because I think they're going to kind of like in time trials where like all these positions got way higher and guys were able to get more aero. I think guys are going to start going a bit higher so they can maintain like an aero position longer. And I think maybe opening up your hip angle, which is the same reasoning to ride short cranks, might produce a bit more power. So I could see that changing like that. That could be a trend I could see. I mean, I think just generally all equipment getting more aero and faster. Probably on the clothing front, we'll see a few developments and stuff.
More heat, less altitude. We talked about this last year.
More heat, same amount of altitude. I think no one's going to stop doing altitude camps and everyone's going to keep increasing the heat.
Well, speaking of the heat, that's likely to be a topic of conversation over the next few days. A Tour Down Under, I believe 40 degree temperatures are forecasters already talk about whether it might affect the racing, whether racing might indeed have to be cancelled or curtailed because of the hot weather. Lionel, should we fill people in on what's happened so far?
Yeah, the 26th edition of the Men's Tour Down Under started with a prologue time trial won by Samuel Watson of Ineos Grenadiers. And from our speculation episode last week, Graham Wilgos's prediction was that Ineos would sooner rather than later ditch the pale grey shorts. Well, Sam Watson rode to victory in some super speedy black shorts. It might well have been a skin suit type affair. Looked like pretty much all the riders were on road bikes with a mix of kind of disc wheels and deep section rims. We might talk about the team time trial that's coming up next week at the Challenge Mallorca as well, Larry, because you'll be there. So Ineos Grenadiers win the first race of the 2026 World Tour season, and that's been followed by another couple of days of racing. Tobias Lund Andersen of Decathlon. A lot of hype about Decathlon and especially their young rider Paul Seksas and apparently their new Van Riesel bike, but Tobias Lund Andersen won the opening road stage, and Jay Vine of UAE Team Emirates pipped his teammate Jonathan Narvaez in a UAE 1-2 on stage two. I wonder how many 1-2s UAE Team Emirates are going to do this season across all of the races. I suspect it might well be quite a few. They're going to win multiple races on the same day, aren't they? When they're competing on more than one front. But yes, UAE Team Emirates already off the mark in the World Tour, thanks to Jay Vine.
Jay Vine winning on the corkscrew. Extremely apt.
There we go. And well, the race will come to its kind of Well, it's High Point, I guess, at Wellunga Hill. And the finish is another day after that. So still 3 days of racing to go. We'll recap the rest of that next week.
It's effectively over, though, as a contest. Would you not agree? In terms of general classification, it is pretty much over. I think, well, the time gaps yesterday was almost a minute, wasn't it? Nadvaez and Vine.
Seeing the way that they rode yesterday or today or whatever, I just don't think anyone's going to touch them because, I mean, Jay Vine was on another level. I mean, Narvaez was able to, like, catch his wheel on the climb, but I don't even think Narvaez took one pull in the last 10K because, like, Jay Vine was so strong. So, yeah, I'd be surprised to see anyone touching them. I mean, impressive 1-2. And, I mean, Adam Yates was maybe the third strongest guy in the race, but he set them up for the win. So it's probably over, but still good racing to watch.
So Jay Vine versus Joao Almeida for the Giro then. Can we say that yet?
No, that won't happen.
No, I'm joking.
Larry, talking of heat, it's just occurred to me, I read somewhere, I think it was a story on Cycling News a few weeks ago, they'd done a test. Was it Cycling News? It was another, or maybe another website. They'd done a test on jerseys and black jerseys. And the conclusion from this study that had been done was that Visma had been disadvantaged last year because of a predominantly black jersey at the Tour de France. I thought this issue, I remember people debating this when ONCE, this great Spanish team, of the early 2000s, late 90s or 90s, and they had a black jersey once at the Tour de France. And I thought it was debunked long ago that black was inherently or would be inherently hotter and disadvantageous. If obviously it depends on the manufacturing methods, but I thought manufacturers were well on top of this. Of course, your team has a all black kit, rigorously black kit.
I mean, I actually don't think it's been debunked. I think it's actually a legitimate. Okay, I'd say material makes a way bigger difference than like the color of the jersey. But I think if you have two equal materials, then probably a lighter color like white is less hot than black. But I know for our team, like, there's no option or no question it will be black, you know, because of like the sponsors and stuff. I think a black jersey looks great. But yeah, it probably is marginally hotter than a white jersey. Whether that has a performance effect, I'm not 100% sure. I would say the material makes a way bigger difference than the color, but yeah, I think there is a small difference, actually.
This was my attempt to explain why Tadej Pogacar's finishing positions are probably higher than yours. When Lionel does his analysis, it's all down to the color of the jersey.
When Team Sky had their black kit, they did debunk this, didn't they? But I think, as Larry's saying, pretty much on the basis that they had a very sort of sheer, lightweight material. It was almost see-through, wasn't it? Their Tour de France jersey especially was almost transparent. I think riders were even concerned about getting sunburnt through it, weren't they?
But at the beginning, the backs of their jerseys were white. But I don't know if it was for that reason or not. But
that was true. Talking of jerseys, didn't intend to bring this up, but we did mention a few months ago, fairly speculatively, fancifully it felt at the time, the possibility that airbag systems would come into professional cycling. And, well, hey presto, we have seen in the last couple of weeks that the Picnic Post NL Firmenich team have been trialing some sort of airbag system in training mainly. I don't think there's any suggestion yet that they're going to debut these in races. Very interesting. And we talked at the time about this has been a controversial issue in skiing, in downhill skiing. It's now obligatory in certain downhill World Cup events. Well, in all World Cup events, in fact, in skiing, as people will see at the Winter Olympics. But there are various issues. You know, there's weight, there's discomfort, there's the fact that once they engage, they have to be sort of sent back to the manufacturer or whatever to be replaced, and it all becomes very complicated. Some skiers believe that they are effective. Some don't and don't want to wear them. Larry, do you think did that sort of raise your eyebrows when you saw? I guess you saw the pictures and the videos of these jerseys inflating.
Yeah, I mean, I saw the video. I mean, it's interesting. I don't know if I have an opinion on it yet because I don't really know enough about it and whether it actually works as it's supposed to. Like, you know, how that will inflate if you're crashing. You know, like, I mean, how does it even know that you're crashing, I guess, would be my first question. whatever the efficacy is when you're about to hit the ground. But it's interesting, and I mean, could be cool. I guess we'll see. You know, I think time will probably tell.
What do you think the Peloton would embrace more readily, airbag jerseys or wearable ice vests that could actually be worn for the duration of a stage?
Oh, I mean, I think people would more happily wear an ice vest than a airbag that's probably going to be hot and annoying. But I mean, I think if they show that it works, I think guys will be like, okay, you know, that's fine. You know, I don't think, I mean, unless it's like totally unwieldy and constrictive or something. But if it's just something that's kind of sitting on your back, I don't think it's a terrible idea, to be honest.
I mean, in my mind's eye, I've just great marketing for Michelin. Bring back the Michelin man. You know, the big kind of... have you seen those inflatable kind of sumo wrestler suits that people buy for sort of... they turn up at the darts wearing them, Daniel. I know you're a big darts fan. But yeah, it's interesting. I certainly think some kind of wearable ice vest might be the next kind of level in the sort of cooling race. Something that could be worn, maybe. I had this kind of vision of riders wearing them and then sort of all discarding them at the bottom of the final climb, a bit like the way they used to discard the helmets when the mandatory helmet rule first came in.
I mean, I actually remember one year... at Tour Down Under, actually it was in Cadell's race, Nathan Haas wore like a frozen, kind of like, it was like an ice vest with like a hydration tube so that like as it melted, he could drink it. And he wore it for maybe like the first hour of the race. But I haven't seen that since. Yeah, I'm not even sure that that's totally legal or not. But anyway, I have seen it before, but only once.
What a brilliant idea. Put a mojito in.
Yeah.
Frozen margaritas.
It does seem slightly disappointing that ice technology hasn't really advanced over the years. Ice continues to melt at the same temperature that it's always melted at. It's really no that, progress has been made on that.
That's not technology, Daniel. That's physics.
The heat-related segues keep on coming because we're going to be talking about burnouts in just a little while. But before we do, Larry, I don't think we've had a podcast yet this winter where you've sort of given us a brief debrief on last year. And what were the sort of big conclusions of the winter in terms of how 2025 went and what you're going to try to adapt, tweak, rethink maybe going into 2026?
Well, I mean, I really enjoyed being on my new team, and I think I was able to have like a really nice role on the team. So in general, that was really positive, especially with like the leaders we have. Yeah, I was able to slot into a really nice role on this team, you know, as like an experienced rider who's kind of like an all-arounder, and I could help in like a lot of different areas. So that was cool. On the personal front, I was pretty happy with my season. The second half was quite good. The first half was okay, but not as good as I was expecting. Yeah, I would say like I started off well, and then like Tirreno, Alps, Giro were not as I was hoping for. I did like a super good altitude camp, but I think just the way that I trained didn't work the way we had hoped, sort of. So, you know, I switched to a new coach, and we had sort of said like, okay, or he said, you know, like, let's try to focus on your weaknesses, improve kind of like your, I guess, punchiness.
This was the new coach.
This was the new coach. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
So work on the weaknesses rather than lean into the strengths. Broadly.
Exactly. And so the thing is like, I mean, I definitely improved all my probably numbers in short efforts, but the problem is like, I'm never going to be a sprinter. So even though I improved my sprint, I'm still not that good at sprinting, you know, like I'll probably still get beat by a good amateur sprinter. So I think I actually improved my weaknesses at the cost of my strength. And so the second half of the year, we decided to change back to what I had done more like the end of the, you know, the year before. And so that would be more working on what I'm strong at, so lower intensities, so around my threshold, improving my threshold, things like that, so that like I could be stronger over the course of the day, and then probably a bit better on the climbs. Then I'd always be there sort of like at the finish to help the leader. So yeah, that's what we ended up doing the second part of the year, and that worked really well. So that would be like more high zone two training, like fat max, you could call it my first threshold. And then also just general like threshold training. So a lot around my second threshold, my anaerobic threshold or LT2. And then I would say like working on those two thresholds, those zones we get kind of like thrown out at the beginning of the year. The beginning of the year we did like super polarized training, is so either long and super easy or like super intense and not much in between. And essentially the second part of the year, we just kind of hit all the zones instead of throwing out the middle zones. And I had done a lot of strength training at the start of the year. I kind of like nixed that the second part of the year. And yeah, in the end, all of that worked quite well. And I was, yeah, a lot stronger the second part of the year. So that's kind of like now going forward, moving in that direction again.
Lionel talked earlier, shamed you by referring to the longevity of your career. Said, well, you've been around a long time, 14 years. It's fascinating that still after 14 years that tweaks happen and have to, and obviously it's a bit of a moving target because the sport itself is evolving, and that's probably explains most of the tweaks, that it's sort of new solutions for new problems. But it is intriguing, and it's it always intrigues me that riders can go through a whole career and either feel as though they haven't figured it out or they have figured it out at certain moments of their career, only to then realize that no, maybe they do need to change things again. It's do you think you're unusual in that? Do you know riders, do you know fellow pros who really have changed very, very little over the course of a 10-year career?
I mean, I think the only difference is like if you don't change teams. So, you know, the thing is like now it probably used to be in the sense of like, when you back in the day before like team coaches became mandatory, you know, probably a lot of riders had one coach their whole career, right? So then they would just always probably, they'd figure out what worked and then they'd stick to the same training their entire career. You know, even when I started, I mean, every team I've ever been on, most guys were coached in-house, if not almost everyone. It was like almost always a team policy that like you were coached in-house. And now it later ended up becoming a rule from the UCI that you have to be coached by the team. There's still ways around that where like guys can have a personal coach and then they're overseen by, you know, a coach in the team.
I mean, but, I find Gemini to be very good, Larry.
I mean, honestly, it's probably good, and that's probably where we're going. But I think that's probably where it's changed. So now everyone who changes teams essentially changes coaches, and then, you know, different coaches have different training methods. So yeah, so then everyone's constantly changing, sort of. So even look at Pogacar. I mean, he had one coach the first however many years of his career. Then he changed coaches and changed a bunch of training, even though he was still very, you know, one of the best in the world. So, but yeah, it's interesting. Today I rode with Will Barta, who's now my teammate, and Kevin Vermaak. And Kevin Vermaak just switched from Picnic to UAE. He was saying how his training's like totally different than before. And I don't know, and he likes the way it is, but, you know, it's totally different. So I would say it's a pretty common thing to change, especially if you change teams, change coaches. Yeah, I guess you're always like, okay, well, I might as well try something new. You know, I guess you always hold this hope out also, like, maybe I'll fly, you know, like, maybe this is why I wasn't winning all the races before, you know? I think in my case, I kind of realized, like, I did find a recipe that had worked sort of the year before, but I was still willing and open to try something new, and then it didn't work that well, so sort of switched back to more what I was doing in 2024.
On your training ride today, Larry, did you overtake Jim Ratcliffe and Dave Brailsford, or were they going the
other
way?
No, they were going the other way. So, but we did wave, you know.
As they passed, did you hear any sort of Ineos Grenadiers strategy being talked about, or were they pushing on? Was Brailsford on the front?
We were kind of pushing on, so we ended up going kind of fast. I mean, I think they had just stopped for a piss, but, you know, they were starting again. So,
well, Jim Ratcliffe's got his hands full with Manchester United Football Club at the moment. Dave Brailsford's been relieved of that particular hot potato for the time being, and now has his focus back on the cycling team, doesn't he? His job is to help Oscar Onley avoid difficult second album syndrome that we talked about last week, Daniel.
Incidentally, on Oscar Onley, I don't know whether, I think we cited another source, we might have cited one of our colleagues, I think Andy Hood maybe reported the fee that was paid to take Oscar Onley from Picnic Post and Elfermanic to Ineos Grenadiers, and the reported figure was €6 million. Ineos Grenadiers are adamant that it was less than that. I was contacted by someone this week.
I don't think Andy Hood, I don't think, we didn't mention a figure, did we? We didn't mention a figure last week. I don't think we mentioned a figure, did we?
I don't know if I read that. I mean, maybe I did see that. But then I also read that, like, Juan Ayuso was $10 million to break out of his contract. So I'd say for Ineos, relatively, that's a good deal. In the sense that he's British, he was fourth in the tour.
The story was that the transfer fee for Oscar Onley was higher than the transfer fee for Remco Evenepoel, but the wages were lower for Onley than for Evenepoel.
Okay, I did read that also.
Who knows?
Also, on that transfer, I saw some quotes from Ivan Spekenbrink, who's the manager of Picnic Post NL. They talking about how cycling desperately needs a transfer system. And I was slightly puzzled by that. And in fact, I was talking to an agent today, and he was also puzzled by it, because football doesn't really have a transfer system either. It simply has the arbitrary figures that teams agree to pay to each other to release players from contracts. And that is exactly what's starting to happen in cycling.
Which is all enshrined in EU law, isn't it? And the Jean-Marc Bosman case, which in the old days of football, there was a kind of a system that people in football, the price that was offered, could either be accepted or rejected. You know, that, and that's very much what happens in cycling today and football today. The difference is that if a rider's out of contract, there's no transfer fee. If a footballer's out of contract, there's no transfer fee. It's only when one party wants to get the other party out of their existing contract that any money has to change hands, which, but in the old days, the football clubs could hold on to the registration. And even in cycling, I think there were situations in the 90s, certainly, where riders wanted to leave, but they wouldn't be released from their registration, even though they didn't have a contract or they hadn't agreed new terms, and there were all kinds of wrangles. But the Jean-Marc Bosman case tipped the balance back in favour of the athletes. Once they're free of their contract, they're free to negotiate a move to anywhere without being held to ransom by their previous employer. So that's the system that exists, and it's probably the fairest one all round. But if you want to buy a highly valuable rider out of their contract, it's going to cost money, and there's no way that you could have a sort of third party arbitration to sort of decide what that fee should be, because it would be up to the team that holds the registration and the contract to accept or decline an offer. And that's kind of what happens. I suppose where we, you know, like in football these days, there's either transfer fees which are made public, or the old favourite in the world of journalism, so-and-so has moved for an undisclosed fee. And that's what we have in cycling, really. It's not in anyone's interest to say, oh, it's cost us $5 million to get Oscar Onley, because it makes Ineos look like money bags and it puts a lot of pressure on Oscar Onley. So really, those details kind of stay behind closed doors for understandable reasons.
Yeah, more and more so in football as well, because it also, disclosing the fee will kind of weaken the hand of in the market of the team that receives a lot of money and can then, you know, is then looking for a replacement and so on and so forth. I think we're going to talk about a rider who has just another rider who's just been transferred one team to another in part three.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car, the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind me to tell you that this episode is also sponsored by Saley, a new eSIM service. It's an app brought to you by the creators of NordVPN, and it can help you to keep your roaming costs down when you're traveling outside your own country, because it's an affordable eSIM with data plans to cover more than 200 destinations. With a Saley eSIM, you'll always have a connection when you need one as well. How does it work? Well, instead of going to the airport when you arrive and buying a local SIM, you don't have to buy anything physical. You just download the eSIM app once on your device, and then you subscribe to the global or regional plan that covers the area that you're going to be in. So it saves you time, it's simple, it's easy, it's secure, and it can save you money because the roaming charges can be reduced significantly, and it will save you mobile data because Saley's built-in ad blocker stops browser ads from loading, and that can reduce your data usage by up to 28%. The Saley eSIM is brought to you by the creators of NordVPN, so you know that it's secure as well. If you download the Saley app from your app store and use the code cycling at checkout, you'll get an exclusive 15% off your first purchase. So search Saily, that's S-A-I-L-Y, in your app store, or go to saily.com/cycling for details.
Well, chaps, I promised that in this part we'd be talking, among other things, about a rider who's recently changed teams. That rider is Derek G. West, formerly known as Derek G. Derek married last autumn, Lionel, I think you said.
October, yeah. October. Married Ruby West, also a cyclist, so Ruby is now Ruby G. West as well.
And of course, Derek G. was in the news in the late summer. It was more in the late summer than the autumn, wasn't it? Because just before the Vuelta a España, he announced that he was breaking his contract with what was then Israel Premier Tech. It all became very contentious, not least because of what then happened at the Vuelta with that team, and seems to be no resolution in sight. There were threats of legal action, very expensive legal action. But eventually, 2 or 3 weeks ago, a solution was found whereby the team formerly known as Israel Premier Tech agreed to let Derek G. West go. He had a contract. I can't remember when his contract was supposed to expire, but it was well into the future, shall we say. He had at least 1 year left on his deal, but his former team agreed to let him go and he found a new home at Little Trek. Now, last week I and a number of other journalists were invited to have a call with Derek G. It wasn't clear beforehand whether we would be able to discuss his separation, his conscious uncoupling, to use a phrase that Gwyneth Paltrow once infamously used about her separation from Chris Martin. But it wasn't clear whether we would be able to discuss that or to what extent we would be able to discuss that with Derek G. And then we got on the call and we were told that Derek did not want to linger too much on the past, or indeed at all, which was a sort of invitation not to broach that topic. However, he did mention it briefly. He mentioned the emotional toll the last few months had taken. Going to hear a little bit about that now.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, obviously it was very, very top. I mean, incredibly, but it's also the kind of thing where because that's your everyday, it's all consuming. And then as soon as, you know, you arrive at team camp, you're on a new team, it really leaves you pretty quickly. It was, I'm not going to exaggerate and say it was fine. It was a very, very tough period, but it's not something that stuck with me. It hasn't lingered. And honestly, I feel kind of like fresh, remotivated, ready to get back in the peloton.
Derek, most riders, when they get to 28, you feel as though, well, we and they feel as though they've probably glimpsed most of their potential. Obviously, your career is a bit different. You've only really had 2 years of going for GC. Do you feel there's still quite a lot of potential that's unexplored?
Yeah, massively. I mean, I went pro by today's standards very late. 25. I've done 3 seasons and I only started GC at the Dauphiné in 24. So I think there's a ton still to go, even physically. Obviously, the first bit was a big learning curve, and that's where I think I improved the most, was just learning how to ride GC, because that was very new. But I think even physically, there's still quite a bit of improvement to go. I can't say for sure that I'm going to get better, but I hope, I know there are some areas that I still need to improve, and hopefully those can translate to results.
I know it's difficult to say. And, you know, the question we're always guilty of asking, do you think you can get to the Vingegaard level, the Pogacar level, but is that kind of where your sights are set, or do you put any kind of ceiling on it?
I don't put a ceiling on it, but I'm definitely not looking there. I think there's a lot of riders. There's a lot of levels of rider between me and them, and it's just one step at a time, trying to improve, trying to reach that next level. I mean, those guys have both won multiple Grand Tours. My goal is to reach that podium for now, and just try and chip away it bit by bit. Obviously, it's a big goal, and just because I've come fourth, I could improve across the board and not improve on the result based on the field, based off the luck. It's bike racing, you know. But my goal is just to put everything in place as best I can in order to help myself make it as easy as possible to try and make that step.
So chaps, that was Derek G talking a little bit about what had happened in the autumn and also arriving at Little Trek, his ambitions and so on and so forth. Larry, do you see Derek G thriving at Little Trek?
To be honest, I think he made some huge steps the last couple of years. I think already that Giro that he did in 2023 was like insane. I guess just what he's done since, especially last year, he was so impressive the first half of the year. I just don't see him stopping, and I see him continuing to grow. And then the way that team has been going, you know, it's a super strong team with, seems like they're really well organized. They have good staff, good riders, so he'll have great support. I only see him going up, to be honest.
I asked him there, Larry, whether he put any sort of ceiling on his potential, whether he thought that he could kind of penetrate the sort of VIP rope behind which only Tadej Pogacar and Jonas Vingegaard reside. You know, whether he could one day be considered in that bracket, sort of at the very top, or is it the sort of tier below or the tier below that? I mean, where do you think he sits in terms of the hierarchy of the best GC riders potentially?
I could see him falling into that second tier. No, I could definitely see him reaching the podium in a Grand Tour. He has that level, and then he has the capabilities. You know, he's obviously not tiny. He time trials extremely well also. So, you know, I think that's like a big advantage over some other guys. So some of the guys who are just pure climbers, they struggle when there's like long TTs, things like that. So I think he's just a really well-rounded rider with a huge engine. So I can definitely see him on the podium of a Grand Tour in the next couple of years. And I think he'll regularly be able to challenge for the podium in like the 1 week World Tour stage races.
Really beefs up Little Trek as well, doesn't it? I mean, their smart recruitment, you know, very big signing with Juan Ayuso going there. But when you look at the riders that they've got and the way that they can choose to deploy them over the Giro d'Italia and the Tour de France, they've really got two A-teams there, haven't they? You know, they can afford to send Jonathan Milan to the Giro, and Mads Pedersen will be probably the favourite for the green jersey at the Tour de France, or certainly one of the favourites. They've got GC riders who can target one race exclusively, G West for the Giro and Ayuso for the Tour. And then, you know, a really, really strong cast of support riders, kind of sort of super domestiques, really. I mean, domestiques deluxe, I guess. Yes. Quinn Simmons, Skelmoser, Vacek. Very, very strong. Oh, Ciccone, of course, you know, who will be...
I think Skelmoser would be offended to be considered a domestique, but yeah.
Well, I mean, I'm talking about in a sort of Grand Tour sense, you know.
Bernie Slam Skelmoser.
He's got other objectives in the spring, hasn't he? But when you consider, you know, Derek G wanted to leave his previous team, there probably weren't too many better places he could end up than... Little True. Trek. I can't think of anywhere better, actually. I mean, there was speculation, wasn't there, about Ineos Grenadiers. They've expressed a bit of surprise that they were linked to...
Incident in the call last week, he said that he thought that was completely fabricated. I'm not sure I'd... You know, I mean, you might say, well, of course he's going to say that now. It's certainly... That information certainly seems to come from pretty good sources at the time. It wasn't me personally that reported it, but it was reported by some very authoritative journalists. But he was adamant that he was surprised to read that and there was never any substance to it.
I mean, I think he's a pretty genuine guy. So I feel like if he said that, then it was probably legit. But maybe Ineos was interested, but he just never knew about it.
Not an original point. Other people have mentioned this as well. But given what happened with Simon Yates, then had they known earlier that Simon Yates was not going to continue his career, then he's the kind of guy who certainly would have filled a big hole for his Melissa bike.
Yeah.
Another hot topic this autumn, Larry, because it's come up in various interviews on various platforms with various riders, is the increasing pressure on professional cyclists, the sort of spectre of burnout, or the reality of burnout that some riders are suffering. We've been talking for years now about the likelihood that careers are going to get shorter. Because we had the opportunity to speak to him last week, I thought I'd see what Derek G. West had to say about that. Here's what he did say.
It's really, really tough for me to speak on this because I think a noticeable shift happened post-COVID.
the racing got faster, the amount of camps increased, all of this. It's all I've ever known as a pro. Also, having gone pro when I was 25, I'd been to the Olympics on the track. I was a fairly, established person. I was an adult. I wasn't picked up when I was, 17 years old. So there's so many factors that play into, I think, this sense of pressure on the riders. Obviously, if you're picked up straight out of high school and you go professional and you're on the road so many days a year, for sure, I can see it having an effect. But at the same time, it's tough for me to compare and contrast how that was versus how it used to be before kind of this marked shift in the approach to the sport.
For example, I've noticed your team, your new team, and you've probably not met them yet, but I think your team is either three or five psychologists. Presumably, you feel that that's a good thing and something that you also will make use of.
It's definitely not something that I'm used to, but I think that's a really good thing. I think it's obviously incredibly healthy for people. And yeah, you can't be too robotic about it, and you can't take the humanity out of bike racing, because then you will definitely have shorter careers if it comes to robotics. From a wellness perspective of the individuals in the sport, as well as from the team's perspective of having healthy, happy riders who deliver results and performances for as many years as possible, I think that's a great way to go, and I think you'll probably see a lot of teams follow suit in the future.
Larry, that was interesting. I thought a perceptive, very kind of self-aware point that Derek G. West made there about how he felt that when he turned pro, because he turned pro later than a lot of his peers, he was a more sort of fully formed adult, and he'd experienced more of real life, because it seems that a lot of the sort of concerns on that we have and others have on behalf of professional cyclists at the moment are also derived from what we know about these sort of hothouse environments now, where teenagers are developing and also being fast-tracked into the World Tour very early, at sort of 18, 19, 20 years old, years of age, before they are fully formed adults. And this is seen as sort of one of the inherent dangers of how the sport has gone. But this topic generally of burnout pressures and the likelihood of shorter careers, do you see it as a sort of myth or reality already?
I mean, I definitely think burnout is a reality.
Define that, Larry, because burnout is a problematic term, because it is it's an official sort of, it's a diagnosis used in medicine, but it's also, a lot of people use that term in a more sort of nebulous kind of general way of just bit of overwhelm.
I guess in the sense of, like, to me, I guess all of the above, like whether you want to consider it a medical diagnosis or not, I think it's just, there is a lot of pressure. And then, I would say most cyclists put a ton of pressure on themselves, like you don't get to this level without expecting a lot of yourself. So even if there's not pressure from the team, to perform, to reach a certain weight, to train a certain way, to do a certain amount of camps, whatever, you expect yourself to do the max, to your capabilities. And then, I think you feel the pressure, even if there isn't necessarily direct pressure put on you from the outside. So that's hard, and I guess I see the way, it's developed over the years, just in terms of, like, guys were probably a lot more relaxed before, if you would go to a training camp, before, guys would have some drinks every now and then, maybe when I started, maybe every night, not everyone, but like guys on the team would, like maybe at training camp, there would be bottles of wine on the table every night. And then even I remember when I was a Neo Pro, every race, there was like a bottle of wine on the table every night, And, it'd just be like guys weren't so uptight and stressed, whereas like, now guys would be like, they won't touch a drop of alcohol from January through October because, Andrew Huberman says it's bad for your sleep and stuff. So, I think like the problem is, guys are like, okay, I need to perfect everything. So, you know, it's like now we're tracking everything, you know, everyone's wearing like an Aura or a Whoop. And then, you know, they're like, okay, if my sleep score wasn't perfect last night, if I didn't get 8.5 hours of sleep, like, you know, I'm not going to be good today. And then, you know, some of the teams are measuring this stuff. And then, you know, there would be the pressure to be like, oh, well, you better be sleeping better because you're not sleeping that well. Oh, you had a new kid? Well, I mean, you got to make sure that, like, you're still sleeping. And then, you know, I guess there's also now the food is like a huge thing, you know. So in the past, it was always like, yeah, you got to be lean or whatever. But they didn't say, like, how to do it. So, you know, maybe guys didn't do it the right way. They'd starve themselves or whatever. Or they just, like... Now it's like, okay, weigh everything, measure everything.
Are you doing that?
Make sure you're
at home.
Right now I am, yeah. It's not like required, but we use an app called Hexis on our team. So we just started to use it. And to be honest, it's better than some of the other apps I've used in the past. So I find it pretty easy to use. And I think right now for me, it's like important to lose a bit of weight going into the start of the season. So using this app facilitates that so that you can train well while also like losing a bit of weight, you know. But, you know, maybe I'll do it for like a couple months and then I won't do it for a couple months and then I'll do it for a couple months. So, you know, I guess the one thing I've gotten really good at over the years is just finding out how to have balance over the course of the year. So when to like go all in and when to let off the gas a little bit. And, you know, I know a lot of guys, they just don't know how to ride that wave, sort of. They just go like all in, all in, all in, all in, all in, and then they explode, you know?
When you say they explode, have you seen this overwhelm? I mean, without mentioning individuals, and kind of what form have you seen that take?
Yeah, so like, you know, I have a friend who in the last years, he'd always be like, oh, you know, do like all these altitude camps, you know, January, he'd be in like Sierra Nevada alone, like, just training like crazy, thinking like he has to be at altitude all the time, measuring all his food, whatever. And then it's like by March, April, like he cracked, you know? And then like, and then it's almost like for the rest of the season, he's like on the limit, you know?
Again, cracked how?
Like mentally and physically. I don't know, like instead of like being, you know, competing for results, you're like, I don't know, finishing Gruppetto every single day, you know, because I don't know, you don't want to be there. You don't feel good. You know, I think like, you know, your body can also like go over the edge as well, you know? So like you reach just like a state of fatigue that like is hard to get out of. So I'd say like that happens with, I think a lot of guys is they don't know where to like pull back or when to pull back. And I think that's a hard line to find as well. And some guys think like, well, if I have balance, I won't be as good as I could be. Maybe for some guys that's possible, but I think it's more like you just need to find out what is the best balance for you. You know, maybe for some guys, they need more time to relax than others. But, you know, I'd say, for example, I mean, you look at a guy like Kian Uytebroeks, you know, I think like, you know, he goes all in, all in, all in, all in, all in, and then just boom, blows up or something, you know? So it works for a certain period, but then after a moment, like everything goes out the window. And then, you know, a guy who should regularly be, you know, in the top 10 of World Tour races is nowhere close to it. So I think it is a big issue. The other thing is then you have that accumulation over years of that, like going all in, you know? And I think the thing is you see like certain teams, it's probably more challenging than others. So you have Visma, for example, who, I mean, I think they're definitely on the forefront of all the training, nutrition, everything. It requires a lot of commitment and motivation and dedication. And I think that can get fatiguing, you know? So I think a lot of their guys, they track all their food, you know, everything, probably November to October. Maybe they have a few weeks off, but that's it, you know?
I mean, this is where we in the media are maybe sort of unwittingly complicit in this because we love those stories, don't we, Lionel? When, I mean, the media always laps up those stories in professional cycling. As soon as the team is successful, okay, you go looking for, you speak to the coach or the nutritionist who will give the impression, we'll feed you some sort of narrative about why this team has an advantage over all of the others. And of course, a young rider is going to see these stories, listen to these podcasts, and they're going to be influenced by that as well. So there's no kind of, if you want to be successful, there's no opt-out. You have to do what the best are supposedly doing. We probably inflate the importance of these things. I mean, we did it maybe for years with Team Sky, for example.
I think a lot of this stuff is probably important if you want to like be on the margin. If you want to continue doing it for a long time, you need to know when to dial it back a bit, you know? And I'd say even like a guy like Pogačar, I think he's actually pretty good at like having balance, you know? I think he does go all in at certain periods, and I think he relaxes at other periods. So we only see the end result where he's just absolutely flying. But I think he's super good at, like, you know, knowing when to dial it up and when to dial it back. Okay, it's maybe easier to do when you are one of the best in the world, so you get to choose your exact schedule, you know? So then you can work that into your season. Whereas, like, maybe someone like me who doesn't get to choose their schedule, I mean, maybe to a little bit, but not much, you know, like essentially you go where they tell you, and then that can be a little harder to know, you know, when to, yeah, how to have balance, because like you don't get to necessarily choose your blocks of like, okay, here I can go rest here, maybe go on like a little vacation or something, or, you know, it's kind of like you just have to roll with the flow and hope that you can work it out, you know. But it's definitely taken me a really long time to get to that point. I used to think that like I would be my best if I just went to the top of a mountain and locked myself up there for 3 weeks and measured all my food and didn't eat that much and trained super hard. And then I kind of realized that like actually to be my best, I need to balance it a bit.
It seems to me you have to be a certain type of person as well to kind of cope with the mental load of all of that screen time, for one thing, and also the accountability of all those numbers, you know, knowing that every gram of carbs is tracked, every effort in training is tracked, your sleep score is tracked, you know, and also manage the kind of the guilt of thinking, well, if I hadn't gone to the cinema on Tuesday, maybe I would have trained better on Wednesday, or whatever it happens to be. You know, how do you allow yourself to have a regular life, which is important for sort of a mental equilibrium?
That's just something that's come over time, at least for me. But I think that is why we're seeing probably a different type of character becoming a pro cyclist today than we probably saw 15 years ago. And that's why I think you see all these guys from like my generation, for example, really struggling after a few years of like the new way of doing things that, you know, it's like, I think Simon Yates, for example, you know, I remember talking to him in 2024 and like at the start in Catalonia one day. And I remember him mentioning to me being like, yeah, I don't know if I really want to keep doing this, you know, like, I don't know, we'll see. I don't know. I might just like, he said something like, I might just stop. And I was like, holy shit, that's pretty crazy. You know? Cause like, he's still super good. But, you know, then it was like, okay, he decided like, you know what, maybe I'll just give it one more go and try to, you know, go to the best team in the world, see what I could do, you know, and then he wins the Giro. But I think, again, he probably was like, why do I keep doing this? In the sense of like, he probably went home over Christmas, enjoyed himself, you know, had fun with his family and friends, was relaxed, ate what he wanted, had a few drinks, and then was probably like, what am I doing this for? You know, like, I mean, he probably has quite a few millions in the bank account. He's already won 2 Grand Tours, probably not going to win the Tour de France. In the end, like, what more does he have to accomplish? And he's probably just like, why would I put myself through this anymore if I don't have to, you know? And I don't know. I think like people see this as like this big shocking revelation. But I think this was a guy who was probably like mentally on his limit for a few years already. And then was just like, you know what? I'm out.
So it's probably more about time spent at that elite level rather than age, because Simon Yates, I think, had 12 years in the World Tour, retired at the age of 33 and a bit. Primoz Roglic, this is his 11th year in the World Tour. I know he had a few seasons at the next level down as he was kind of adjusting from winter sports to professional cycling, but he's 36. And then Derek G. West, I mean, he turned pro at 25, he's 28 now. So, I mean, in pro cycling years, he's really only like 21 years old, isn't he? You know, he's only got relatively few kilometers on the clock, 3 years at this level of intensity. So, you know, he may well have a kind of a longer tail to his career post 30 because of he won't have spent a long time at the high level. I guess what will be interesting, you know, because this is all kind of anecdotal and it's all very individual as well, it will be interesting to see just how long some of the careers of these phenomenal riders who turn pro at 18, 19, 20, how late they manage to stick around in the sport. If they're still going at sort of 35, 36, that would be, well, it'd be very interesting to see if anyone makes it that far, I guess.
Mm. I mean, as you say, Lionel, it's very individual, isn't it? That you can, you know, Larry, you've sort of almost outlined there a recipe for dealing with some of these things, but everyone's was a principle in sort of psychology called the window of tolerance, and everyone's window of tolerance is a different breadth, a different width, and, mm-hmm. and you know, there are some people that for whom a lot of these things you're describing as stressful or could be stressful, they won't feel like stress to some people, and for some people they will feel incredibly stressful. You're laughing, you're smiling.
Same applies at the cycling podcast, Daniel, doesn't it? I think we have very different windows. I think I have the round window, you have the square window.
I'm not sure what to think about that. Anyway, just before we move on to the last couple of things, Larry, do you know anyone who's really kind of pushing back, or who's making a success of pushing back against this sort of hyper-controlled environment and hyper? I mean, I was thinking of Victor Lafay a minute ago.
Yes, but I mean, would we consider it a success if he like only does like one race a season? You know, I mean, I don't know. Like,
I read an interview with him yesterday. Correct me if I'm wrong. I don't know if you know this. Does he have a girlfriend in China? Because he seemed to be talking about having peers.
Well, I mean, I think he met some girl in China, okay. But I don't know if I'd call it a girlfriend.
Right. He seemed to be talking about just taking a break in his season in a few weeks to go to China to see.
I mean, that's very possible. But like, this guy is just a phenomenon as a person, you know, like. But yeah, I mean, okay, yes, this guy can exist, but I think because he's just an unreal talent, you know, I don't think that's an example of like a way that a lot of people could do it. I think if I did what Victor Lafay did, I would have been out after 6 months of cycling. You know, I mean, I don't think that works for everyone. I think that guy is just like really a phenomenon. And so it's works. But I'd say like, I don't know, my teammate Matteo Trentin, he's pretty good at like, yeah, I mean, he has pretty good balance, you know, he has two kids, you know, he's there for his family, he trains hard, but he doesn't go so crazy on the nutrition, you know, like, I mean, he just knows what to do. Yeah, doesn't do anything crazy, and yeah, he's still like a really good rider and really good pro. So I'd say he's like a pretty good example of like, yeah, not having to do the crazy new school stuff and still pretty much thriving.
Before we get out of here, we need to fill, well, I'm sure the listeners know already, certainly the UK-based listeners, but the routes of the first three stages of the 2027 Tour de France, which are going to take place in Great Britain, were unveiled last week.
They were. Well, we already knew that the Grand Départ was going to be in Edinburgh in 2027. The race will start on Friday, July the 2nd.
Friday? Does it start on a Friday?
Yeah, it starts on a Friday, Daniel. So
why?
Well, I'm assuming there'll be a transfer day.
Yeah.
Why do they need a day for a transfer from the UK? Maybe will the race resume from the south of France rather than the north?
Maybe, yeah, that could be it. Anyway, stage one will go from Edinburgh to Carlisle in the north of England, the gateway to the Lake District. Then there'll be a stage from Keswick to Liverpool. Quite long stages, actually, all three of these, aren't they? And then Welshpool to Cardiff. Cardiff, of course, the home city of Geraint Thomas, 2018 Tour de France winner. And as you say, we don't know what happens beyond that, but because they're starting on a Friday, my bet would be a Monday transfer. And as you say, Daniel, maybe that is exactly it. They're going to be going down to the south or maybe the middle of France rather than across to resume in the north. The Tour de France Femmes also starts in the UK next year. Brings back memories of 2014 and the men's Tour de France, because the start will be in Leeds on Friday, July the 30th. Then there'll be a stage from Manchester to Sheffield. Then there will be a stage in London before the race heads back across the Channel. So big summer of cycling in the UK in 2027.
Larry, what Grand Tour for you this year?
Normally, I will do the Giro and the Vuelta, but we'll see. We'll see what happens.
But you're starting in Mallorca.
Yes.
Which is next week. Five 1-day races. Do you know yet how many of them you're doing?
Three of them. Right. Three of them, yeah.
Okay. Are you doing the team time trial?
I'm not doing the team time trial. And then I'm not doing the last sprint day. So I'm just doing the three harder races.
Do you think that the team time trial will be... will teams be taking all of their time trial bikes and so on?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure, for sure. Oh, okay. Yeah, 100%. I mean, I'm assuming... that like a lot of teams are going to take it pretty seriously, considering, you know, there's like a team time trial to start the Tour de France. So I would assume a decent amount of teams are going to want to be like, this is a really good practice run. I don't know. At least that's how our team's approaching it. So I would assume there are quite a few teams that are going to approach it like that. So, you know, there's not that many team time trials throughout the year. So I think a lot of teams like to use that as like a dry run.
It's also just over the water, very short hop to Barcelona. So if they are taking people who they think are going to be involved in the Tour team time trial, they might go and look at the route as well with those riders.
I don't know. I mean, the problem is how you're going to see in the middle of a city. It's tricky, I mean, the problem is like,
just for a sort of flyby on an electronic scooter or something. I don't know. Electric scooter. Yeah. Anyway, Lionel, any other business?
Well, just continuing on Mallorca. I mean, there's quite a strong field heading there, perhaps for that very reason. The provisional start list also includes Remco Evenepoel as one of the riders on the long list for Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe. We might see him make his debut there.
Disastrous season there.
No. He'll probably win there, but...
I went to the Challenge Mallorca last year, made a little mini series called Never Mind the Baleariacs, which is a play on the old Sex Pistols album.
If you have to explain the reference, generally.
I know. It predates Larry. I realised Larry was only born in 1990. Music had already moved on from punk by then. If anyone wants to kind of whet their appetite for the Challenge Mallorca next week, that five-part mini-series is on our regular feed from last January. Just wanted to pick up a couple of things from last week's speculation episode, Daniel, because you mentioned your 26 predictions for 2026, and that prompted me to put my 26 predictions together, and we released that in the 1101 Cappuccino last week, or early this week, I think it went out. And if you don't subscribe already to the 1101 Cappuccino, you can do so on our website, thecyclingpodcast.com, or directly on Substack. And you can have a look at that. One of my predictions was that the Giro d'Italia would unveil plans for a Grande Partenza in either Abu Dhabi or Saudi Arabia. Now, some intelligence reaches me that it may well be that the smart money on the next foreign start for the Giro should be on Armenia. So we'll watch that space. Talking of another couple of things that have caught my eye this week, I guess this is a kind of post-podcast edition of the Newsette, but... one thing that I'm looking forward to, as ever, the first proper race of the season, Omloop Het Nieuwsblad. They are reintroducing the 10 Bos climb in Brakel for the first time since 2018. Quite an interesting climb, that one, because it's got a real dead turn at the bottom. It makes the finale of the race harder, leading into the Mur and the Bosberg. It's also where, it's kind of famous because Johan Museo kind of broke the code of the Tour of Flanders in 1998 by attacking there rather than waiting for the Mur. So we will see 10 Bos back in Omloop.
Seeing that, and also seeing the RCS announce the change, tweaked Strade Bianche route on the same day, it made me think that it's sort of high time. I know the teams and riders often get, Larry, you guys often get the route information a little bit earlier, but it seems to me slightly, dare I say, amateurish that you've got big races, which could conceivably be the big objectives of someone's season. Sort of,
and then this course just changes.
Yeah, just unveiled in a completely reconfigured compared to sort of last year or whatever. I mean, this wouldn't happen. So, you know, I was thinking about amateur sport. They wouldn't do this for a major, a marathon that a sort of weekend warrior would take part in.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, but maybe that's one of the nice things about our sport is that, like, it can catch you by surprise. You know, I mean, every year can be different, which is kind of cool. No, I mean, we don't get too much inside intel. It kind of depends. The only thing I will say is when you're on a French team, you learn about the French races a lot earlier than everyone else. You know, I remember one year when Paris-Nice introduced like the team time trial. We were like the only team that knew about it, you know? And so we're just training like team time trial at both the winter camps, you know? And then they don't announce it till like January sometime or whatever. Pretty much we find out most of the time when everyone else finds out.
When do they announce the pin positions in a major golf tournament, Daniel? Is that
not good question.
On the day or is that in advance? Do they know all the pin positions?
Good question. I think it depends on the tournament. Yeah. Some of them, the Masters is sort of historic. It's every year on Saturday they're in a certain place and so on and so forth.
Another interesting change, which I alluded to in the 1101 Cappuccino's 26 predictions for 26, thinking that somebody at some point is going to suggest a complete overhaul of the race calendar. And one thing that interested me is that the Tour de l'Avenir has changed the rules to allow professional development teams to take part. Now, the Tour de l'Avenir is kind of the Tour de France of the future. It was won by Paul Sexas last year. It's been won in the past. Egan Bernal, Tadej Pogacar, lots of riders who've gone on to greatness in the World Tour. It's a real reliable proving ground for future talent. In recent years, been run solely on a national team basis. It seems to make sense now with all bar one of the World Tour teams having a development squad. I think Uno X are the only World Tour team that doesn't have a development team for 2026, but it seems like a smart move. And I think there might be some kind of move in the next year or two to try and maybe make the World Tour a bit of a two-tier system so that, you know, the load on the teams can be lightened slightly. And in the sort of second tier of World Tour races, of which the Tour de l'Avenir could become a part, there could be a bit more crossover between World Tour rosters and development team rosters, because now that the teams are all investing all of this money in developing their own talent, there's a lot more at stake, isn't there? And I think probably the teams will start to put a bit of pressure on to kind of narrow the gaps on the path, the ladder of the pathway from development level to World Tour level. So that's one to watch. And then just lastly, Olav Koy, who I think we're all...
We're going to go through your whole list. Just one more.
Right. Because Olav Koy, everyone's looking forward to seeing how he gets on at Decathlon. He's going to be their number one sprinter, but he is going to miss his scheduled start of the season. He was supposed to start at the UAE Tour in February, but he's got a virus, so we will have to wait before we see Koy in sprint action, Daniel. I know you can't wait. You're already signing the death warrant for sprinting anyway. It's a kind of a yesterday's discipline.
That was actually, I listened to a good podcast, RMC, IMC, the French podcast. They did a whole podcast about where the sprinters' days are numbered. And it got me thinking that we should do something similar. But it was interesting. It was food for thought. Yeah, yeah. Anyway, should we call it a day there, Lionel?
Absolutely.
Okay, let's release Larry back into the wild. yeah, he's got food to weigh, and
I was gonna say I got some food to weigh, guys.
To pour over. Yeah.
Some Weetabix.
What was your sleep score for the last hour?
Oh, yeah. Hopefully low.
As long as it's not 100. So we don't want any 100% sleep scores, right, chaps? Well, Lionel, we'll be back next week, and Larry, we'll catch up with you very soon. Enjoy Mallorca. If you need any restaurant recommendations, I would love to,
but unfortunately, I don't think I will be doing much exploring.
Too busy tipping 83 grams of pasta onto your portable scales.
Yeah.
Do you weigh it dry or cooked?
At home, I weigh it dry. At camp, we weigh it cooked. I think it's a lot more accurate if you're weighing it dry, got to make do with what you got.
You get all the big questions on the cycling podcast, eh?
Thank you, chaps.
Thanks, guys.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.